So as I've mentioned, and as you've probably noticed, the sermon I'm about to give is not the sermon that's listed in the bulletin. It's not from the text in the bulletin either. Knox was planning to preach this evening, and then he got pretty sick this week. He was still sick towards the end of the week, and he was saying he would try to preach to you all tonight. He's a tough dude, and as you know, always ready to serve. But it didn't sound like he was doing too great, and so on Friday afternoon, I benched him and told him he could preach his sermon on 1 Kings 11 next Sunday, which means that tonight, you guys are stuck with me. I'm sorry, I wanted to hear Knox preach too. But instead, you have me, and instead of 1 Kings 11, we're going to be looking together at Mark 13 once again. As many of you remember, I preached on Mark 13 a few weeks ago in our morning series on Mark, and I took the entire chapter in one go, which helped us get the big picture of what was going on there. But as I lamented even that morning, we had to just fly through so much material that was really worthy of more reflection. And so I've decided to have it both ways. We did it in one go in the morning, and then tonight and over the summer, I'll preach a short series in which we go through Mark 13 and the Olivet Discourse and consider its application for our lives in some more detail. As I explained back in March, I do take a minority interpretation of this passage and see all of the events immediately described here as being fulfilled in the first century. Let me say a few things about that before we come to our text. First, I'll just tell you up front, the point of this series is not to just argue over and over again, of try to convince you of my position on this passage. I will take opportunities as we go along to explain a little bit more why I interpret the passage the way I do, but the point of spending more time on this is not to do that. It's okay for us to disagree on eschatology. Between the three pastors on the staff and our pastor emeritus, we have all three reformed positions on eschatology represented. And that's fine, we can still work together. I had multiple people in March tell me that they disagreed with my interpretation of Mark 13, and that's okay too. As Dr. Jack Collins, one of my favorite seminary professors, used to say to those who disagreed with him, "I respect your right to be wrong." Kidding aside, eschatology is important, and yet when we read the Bible and we see how often God's people misunderstood God's words to them about the future, it should help us all be humble about our own views on what the Bible says about the future, and also respectful towards those who disagree, and then able even to joke with one another about this topic and our often shared ignorance. In fact, what might be my favorite bit of sermon feedback I've ever received, it came from a congregant after my sermon in March on Mark 13. After I tried to compliment his beard, he told me it wasn't really a beard, it was more just some stubble from a few days' growth. And then he informed me with a smile on his face that his thin facial hair was still more filled out and substantive than my eschatology was. It was an amazing pastoral burn. So, it's okay for us to disagree and joke about these things. Second, even though I think this passage was fulfilled in 70 AD, I still think it has a lot of application for us today. Most of the Bible's descriptions are about things that have already happened, but they're told to us for our instruction. As the Apostle Paul writes in Romans 15, whatever was written in former days was written for our instruction. Writing to the Corinthians, Paul wrote of the Exodus, which had taken place centuries earlier, and then he says to them, now these things took place as examples for us. And to Timothy, Paul could, of course, write, all Scripture is breathed out by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, and for training in righteousness, that the man of God may be complete, equipped for every good work. So these sermons will not just be focused on the past, but they'll be focused on what Jesus' teaching means for us in the present. Third and finally, because I believe the application of these texts to our lives is one step removed from their immediate context, for the most part, even if you disagree with my interpretation about these events being fulfilled in 70 AD, I think you can still usually agree with the applications that I'll present. Because even if you may interpret some of the texts in this series as being primarily about the end of history and Jesus' final return, even if you take that view, then if we're not living in the end times today, you too would likely see these texts as applying to us indirectly, as maybe not speaking directly to our moment, but speaking to the future, and then still containing lessons for the present. So even if we disagree on the immediate meaning of Jesus' words, we can still agree on many of the implications of what Jesus has to say for other times in history, including our own. And so that's what I want to especially focus on as we go through Mark 13. With that said, let's turn to our text for this evening, Mark 13, verses 1 through 8. And as we do, please do listen carefully. This is God's word for us this evening. Mark writes, "And as he, that is Jesus, came out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, 'Look, teacher, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings.' And Jesus said to him, 'Do you see these great buildings? There will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down.' And he sat on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple. Peter and James and John and Andrew asked him privately, 'Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign when all these things are about to be accomplished?' And Jesus began to say to them, 'See that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name, saying, "I am he," and they will lead many astray. And when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines. These are but the beginning of the birth pains." This is the word of the Lord. So as we said back in March, Jesus, in this section of Mark, makes it clear that Jerusalem and that the temple and the religious leadership there are a people, they're really a society, who are under God's judgment. Back in chapter 12, by clearing the temple, Jesus had symbolically declared the temple to be under his judgment. Then after the religious leaders continued to reject Jesus, Jesus left the temple. And this too signaled a judgment of Jesus. As the temple leaders had rejected him, so he would now abandon the temple. Then, on the way out, as we just heard, the disciples point out to Jesus all the wonderful buildings around the temple. Jesus' response is a third declaration of judgment. He says to them, "Do you see these buildings? There will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." Jesus declared that total and utter destruction is coming on Jerusalem and especially on the temple. And Jesus' words were in many ways fulfilled, even in their specifics. The ancient historian Josephus would write about the events of 70 AD in Jerusalem that after Caesar ordered the whole city and temple to be razed to the ground, all the rest of the wall encompassing the city was so completely leveled to the ground as to leave future visitors on the spot no ground for believing that it had ever been inhabited. In other words, not one stone was left upon another. Finally, Jesus indicates that Jerusalem is under judgment in a fourth way here as well. We're told in verse 3 that Jesus sat on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple. And a lot is being evoked in just that one phrase. For one thing, by sitting opposite the temple, Jesus assumes a symbolic posture of judgment. A second, by doing it on the Mount of Olives, he also seems to be alluding to the words of the prophet Zechariah, who spoke of the day when the Lord himself would gather nations against Jerusalem in order to destroy it, and how he'd do it from the vantage point of the Mount of Olives. In four different ways, with his actions and with his words, Jesus has made it clear that Jerusalem is a city under his judgment, under the judgment of God. And the disciples see it, they hear it, and they understand. And in response, they say to him, "Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign when all these things are about to be accomplished?" The disciples are asking Jesus, "When will the temple be destroyed? When will Jerusalem be judged? When will the judgment you've declared be carried out?" Those are the questions they're asking here. They want to know when. And to that end, the disciples essentially ask for a sign of when the judgment is coming in verse 4. That's the setup for what comes next. And what we see in Jesus' response is that when calamity strikes, even in a society under God's judgment, we cannot assume that we know what God is doing. Instead, our calling is to remain faithful and to trust in the Lord's sovereign wisdom. Let me say that again. What Jesus teaches his disciples here is that when calamity strikes, even in a society under God's judgment, we cannot assume we know what God is doing. Instead, our calling is to remain faithful and to trust in the Lord's sovereign wisdom. Let's consider that in a couple parts. First, when calamity strikes, even in a society under God's judgment, we cannot assume we know what God is doing. That's Jesus' basic response in verses 5 through 8. He says to them, "See that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name, saying, 'I am he,' and they will lead many astray. And when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines. These are but the beginnings of the birth pains." The disciples have asked for a sign, and in response, Jesus doesn't give them a sign of when these things will take place. Instead, he tells them in verses 5 through 8 that when calamities come, they shouldn't assume that those things are a sign. Jesus says that there will be wars and rumors of wars, there will be natural disasters and all kinds of struggles, but Jesus tells his disciples not to assume that these things are the judgment that he's talking about. And of course, Jesus' words on this came true in the years that followed. All of these things happened in various forms in the 40 years between Jesus' ascension and the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. Jesus says in those verses that there will be wars and rumors of wars, that there will be international and domestic conflicts, natural disasters, and all kinds of struggle, and there were in the decades that followed. These things happened. These calamities came, and they came upon a society that was under God's judgment. But even so, those things were not the judgment itself. This is a reminder for us that God allows conflicts and calamity in this broken world for a range of reasons. But Jesus says that when those calamities come, the disciples are not to assume that they know what God is doing. Because more often than not, if they try to do that, they're going to be wrong. A good friend of mine who's currently working on his D-Min shared a chapter of a book he was reading for that with me this week by Timothy Tennant, in part on Jonathan Edwards' eschatology. Now, Jonathan Edwards is rightly considered one of the greatest of all American theologians. He was a better theologian than you. He's a better theologian than me. He's a better theologian than maybe whoever your favorite podcaster may be. And so if anyone were to be the person to study the Bible and then to look at history and examine current events and from all of that figure out what God was up to, and when his judgments were coming, if anyone was going to succeed in doing that, it kind of feels like it just might be Jonathan Edwards. And he tried. And he just got it, like, so wrong. Edwards took a historicist reading of the book of Revelation, and as he looked at history and he looked around himself, he placed his moment in time in the 1700s as being the time period between the fifth bowl of judgment and the sixth bowl of judgment in Revelation 16. In Edwards' understanding, the Roman Catholic Church was both Babylon and the beast of Revelation. The Pope was the Antichrist. And both the Roman Catholic Church and the Pope were under God's judgment in Edwards' reading. The fifth bowl of judgment in Revelation 16 he understood as the Reformation, which was both a judgment on the Roman Catholic Church and a revival of true belief. The sixth bowl of judgment, the bowl that was coming, was the next judgment of God on the Roman Catholic Church, he believed, which would consist, he said, in drying up the Catholic Church's wealth. Convinced that taking away the wealth of the Roman Catholic Church would be God's next big act of judgment in the world, Tennant writes that Edwards eagerly looked for signs in the daily news of the wealth of Rome being dried up. He was delighted, for example, to read in the Boston Gazette on September 20th, 1748, about the capture of a Spanish ship laden with riches that was headed for Roman Catholic Spain. Edwards believed, as he did this, that he could discern in such an event what God was up to and how God's judgment was unfolding. Between his reading of current events and his study of the Bible, Edwards was convinced that this judgment on the Roman Catholic Church was close at hand, and that once it came, there would be revival. And with that revival would come the conversion of the Muslims and then the Jews. All of this would culminate then in the golden age of the millennium, when the Christian faith would dominate the globe, which Edwards predicted would begin right about the year 2000. So we made it, guys. The millennium's here. Yay. Now, even as a joke, I don't really mean to be disrespectful to Jonathan Edwards, but the fact is that Edwards is worthy of respect. The fact that that's true, the fact that he's was an incredible theologian, that he was an incredible biblical thinker, is actually sort of the point. Because when possibly the greatest American theologian of history is just so galactically wrong, we need to have a reality check about how much confidence we put in our attempts to discern what God is doing in world events, and whether we can really discern when a calamity is God's definitive act of judgment in the world, or maybe something else that we don't know much about. In Ecclesiastes 8, Solomon writes, "Then I saw all the work of God, that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. However much a man may toil in seeking, he will not find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find it out." God, it seems, often doesn't want us to know what he's doing in the world around us. There is so much that he likes to keep hidden from us. And he's good at it. He's so good that even a man of Jonathan Edwards' mind is made to look like a fool when he claims to know what God is doing in the world, when he claims to see God's coming judgment in this calamity or that one. And if Jonathan Edwards was that incapable of reading God's providence to know what God is doing, then we should not put much confidence in our own abilities to figure out what God is up to. We live in a society that has a lot of sin. Whether it's how we treat the unborn or how we often treat the immigrant, the sexual sin we callously expose our youth to, or our indifference to the civilian casualties our military adventures overseas may cause, whether it's hostility towards the gospel or injustice towards the poor and powerless, there are many reasons to suspect that God is not pleased with our society, that our society may be under the judgment of God. That said, we don't know what course the Lord will take with that. God responded to the oppressive empire of Egypt with judgment and destruction, killing Pharaoh. But he responded to the oppressive empire of Rome with conversion, converting an emperor. Since Jesus has not spoken to us about his plans for our own society as he did for Jerusalem, we don't know exactly what he will do. But we do know, in many ways, that our society deserves God's judgment. And though the Lord may relent in mercy, our society deserves his displeasure and therefore his judgment for a number of reasons. But even if that's true, it doesn't mean that we know what God is up to when a calamity strikes. And that's a warning Jesus gives to his disciples here that we too need to take to heart. The Lord is not slow to fulfill his promises, as some count slowness, Peter tells us. But, Peter adds, the Lord is patient. And he's often more patient than we are. And so it can feel slow to us. The 40 years of persecution and pain and suffering and martyrdom for so many Christian leaders that occurred in Jerusalem over the 40 years between when Jesus declared judgment on the city and when that judgment actually came, those 40 years must have felt long. And sometimes God chooses to take even longer. Israel was enslaved in Egypt for much longer. Rome persecuted Christians for centuries before God converted the emperor. Which means that when calamity strikes, even if we think the society it struck is under God's judgment in general, it doesn't mean that we can know what God is doing in that particular moment, in that particular calamity. It doesn't mean that we can declare that this calamity or that calamity is God's act of judgment for this issue or that sin. We may wonder, we might speculate, but we can't know. And it's important for us to recognize that because Christians who rightly believe in the judgment of God can have a tendency to be overconfident in their ability to then interpret what God is doing in the world, kind of as we saw with Jonathan Edwards. I don't know if we live in especially strange times. It feels to me like we do, but I've never really been an aware adult in any other time period of history, so maybe this is how most people in history have felt. I'm not really sure. But there are a lot of things that might tempt us to try to discern God's works or God's judgment. There's cultural strife in our own land. There's domestic conflict of various kinds. There's war in the Middle East, war in Asia, war in Africa. Wars and rumors of wars really do abound. There's, of course, the unknowns of AI. Just this week, I was reading predictions that some were making of an apocalypse of the internet, as they put it, with the capabilities of one of the newer models. There's economic strife. There's bombastic national leaders around the world with lots of weapons at their disposal. And in the midst of it all, Christians often want to know what God is up to. There's often this sense that if we were spiritual enough and if we were wise enough, then we could just discern what God was doing. And if we knew, we assume that we'd then feel better, that we'd have some peace, that we'd maybe even feel like we have a bit of control in our lives, if we could just know what God was doing. Like the disciples, we want to know when these things will be and what will be the signs when all these things are about to be accomplished. But like the disciples, Jesus refuses to give us such a sign. Like the disciples, he warns us not to jump to conclusions, not to assume we know what God is up to when various things take place. To help us wrap our minds around what this means for us, I find J.I. Packer's words especially helpful in his chapter, God's Wisdom and Ours, in the book, Knowing God. Now, this is a chapter I've quoted from before, but one that I find myself coming back to often. And Packer writes this, describing a train station, he says, if you stand at the end of a platform at York Station, you can watch a constant succession of engine and train movements, which, if you are a railway enthusiast, will greatly fascinate you. But you will only be able to form a very rough and general idea of the overall plan in terms of which all these movements are being determined. The operational pattern set out in the working timetable, modified, if need be, on a minute-to-minute basis, according to the actual running of the trains. If, he says, however, you are privileged enough to be taken by one of the higher-ups into the magnificent electrical signal box that lies athwart platform 7 and 8, you will see on the longest wall a diagram of the entire track layout for 5 miles on either side of the station, with little glowworm lights moving or stationary on different tracks to show the signalman at a glance exactly where every train engine is. At once, you will be able to look at the whole situation through eyes of those who control it. You will see from the diagram why it is that this train had to be signaled to a halt, and that one diverted from its normal running line, and that one parked temporarily in a siding. The why and the wherefore of all those movements become plain once you see the overall position. Now, Packer writes, the mistake that is commonly made is to suppose that this is an illustration of what God does when he bestows wisdom on us. To suppose, in other words, that the gift of wisdom consists in a deepened insight into the providential meaning and purpose of events going on around us, an ability to see why God has done what he has done in a particular case and what he is going to do next. Christians, Packer continues, may drive themselves almost crazy with this kind of futile inquiry. And it is futile. Make no mistake about that. So far from the gift of wisdom consisting in the power to do this, the gift actually presupposes our conscious inability to do it. Instead, Packer writes, the real basis of wisdom is a frank acknowledgement that the world's course is enigmatic, that much of what happens is quite inexplicable to us, and that most occurrences under the sun bear no outward sign of a rational, moral God ordering them at all. Packer continues, the truth is that God, in his wisdom, to make and keep us humble and to teach us to walk by faith, has hidden from us almost everything that we should like to know about the providential purposes which he is working out in the churches and in our own lives. Let me read that last sentence to you again. The truth is, he says, that God, in his wisdom, to make and keep us humble and to teach us to walk by faith, has hidden from us almost everything that we should like to know about his providential purposes, which he's working out in the churches and in our own lives. This, Packer says, is the teaching of Ecclesiastes, but it's also an implication of Mark 13, 1 through 8. The disciples ask for a sign, for insight, for knowledge about where and when and how God's judgment in history will take place. And Jesus' answer is basically a warning that when calamity comes, when they look at the world and they think they know what God is doing, they need to be extra careful at that moment, because they're probably wrong. Calamities come and go. Some will be the judgment of God and a society that Jesus has condemned. Others won't be, though. Others will be other things that God is doing, and the disciples should not presume that they can tell one from the other. And so the first thing that Jesus teaches his disciples here is that when calamity strikes, even in a society under God's judgment, we cannot assume that we know what God is doing. The next thing Jesus tells them is that instead of trying to discern what God is up to, our calling is to remain faithful and to trust in the Lord's sovereign wisdom. First, we should notice that the command, the actual exhortation that Jesus gives to his disciples here, is not about them trying to figure out what God's plans are in the events around them. Rather, Jesus' command here is much more simple than that. It's first about remaining faithful. See that no one leads you astray, he says in verse 5. Do not be alarmed, he says in verse 7. Be on your guard, he says later in verse 9. Jesus calls his disciples to remain faithful, whatever twists and turns may come at them in the world events around them. And remaining faithful doesn't actually require us to know God's master plan or timeline. And again, J.I. Packer gives us another analogy to help us grasp what this actually should look like for us. He says that far from getting the overall view of the whole system from the control box at the train station so that we know what the tracks look like ahead of each train, instead of that, he says what real wisdom looks like, what faithfulness to the Lord looks like in our lives, is like, he says, being taught to drive. What matters in driving, he says, is the speed and appropriateness of your reaction to things, and the soundness of your judgment as to what scope the situation gives you. You do not ask yourself why the road should narrow and screw itself into a dogleg wiggle just where it does, nor why that van should be parked where it is, nor why the driver in front should hug the crown of the road so lovingly. You simply try to see and do the right thing in the actual situation that presents itself. You simply try to see and do the right thing in the actual situation that presents itself. Think of your own experience of driving, not now with familiar roads and well-known destinations, but think instead, as Packer urges, of what it was like when you first learned how to drive, when the twists and turns of the roads were not so familiar to you, when you were not following familiar mental maps in your mind, but you were following where the road led and not really sure what would come after the next turn. Your focus at that time was completely on how to handle the challenges that were right before you. The car whose brake light suddenly flashes in front of you, or the road that suddenly takes a sharp turn, the light that changes faster than you expected. You didn't think primarily about where you were going overall or what lies a mile down the road. For the most part, you had to deal with what was right before you, and dealing with the obstacle a mile ahead would come when you got to it and could see it. In other words, you simply had to try to see and do the right thing in the actual situation that presented itself. Or maybe with some similarities, as Jesus said elsewhere, therefore do not be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. And that can often be what faithfulness looks like. We are to remain faithful, to respond faithfully to each situation as it comes up. And we are to trust then the big plans of history, the key moments of God's judgment, the final outcome of it all, we're to trust those things to the Lord. And the reason we can do that, the reason we can focus on what's before us and then trust those larger things of the future to the Lord, is because the Lord has promised, in the end, to work out all things for the good of his people. And that doesn't mean that things won't get hard sometimes. That doesn't mean that sometimes things won't get ugly. But it does mean that in the end, all things will work for good. In Romans 8, Paul speaks of the coming renewal of the cosmos as being like a birth. Beforehand, he explains, there is pain, but the result is a new world with new life and incredible joy. And that's a good way to speak of the final judgment to come, when Christ will make all things right. But then it's also interesting that in our text this evening, Jesus uses the same metaphor to speak of the judgment that will come on Jerusalem within history. He refers to the calamities that may come before that judgment itself as but the beginnings of birth pains. And speaking that way seems to establish the coming judgment within history, in Jerusalem, in the first century even, as a sort of birth. Judgment will come, but new life will follow. And this is often how God works in history. Yes, he brings judgment. Yes, he brings calamity. But usually the society that has been judged doesn't then just remain a wasteland forever. Usually where one society is judged, God brings something new. He brings new life. Over and over again in history, God has brought down one society or another, one phase of history or another, but over and over again, God has brought something else, something new in its place. We don't know when God will do this or at what pace or in what way, and we shouldn't pretend that we do know such things. But we do know that God is always working for the good of his people. Out of judgment, he brings something new. Out of suffering, he brings new life. Out of calamity, he brings new birth. This is how God worked in 70 AD. While the leaders of Jerusalem lost their power, the Christian church was able to grow and expand even further. And it's how God has worked many other times in history. And so when calamity strikes, even in a society under God's judgment, we cannot assume that we know what God is doing, but instead, our calling really is to remain faithful and then to trust in the Lord's sovereign wisdom. And so, brothers and sisters, let us remain faithful and let us trust in the Lord. Whatever may happen, whatever may come, let us heed the words of Psalm 46, where we are told, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth give way, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble at its swelling. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God will help her when morning dawns. The nations rage, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Come, behold the works of the Lord, how he has brought desolation on the earth. He makes wars to cease to the ends of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Amen.